Hey, it's me. Episode 63 is completely messed up. The sound is way off. It was just fine. I added all the stuff to it, and then I went and did the encoding to MP3, and somehow I got this distortion all the way through the whole thing. It's in the originals. It's in the MP3. I don't know where it came from or how to get rid of it. So if any of my listeners happen to be audio engineering experts and they want to fix that for me, that's awesome. But if not, then you know what? If you guys want to skip this episode, I don't even blame you. I mean, if you're going to listen to it, you know, turn the headphones down a little bit. It's going to blow your ears out. It's bad. But like I say, just skip on to episode 64 and everything will be just fine. Or if you are a new listener to this podcast, you've never heard me before, then for God's sake, just don't even listen to this one. This is not a good introduction. Back up and listen to 61, 62, something like that. You'll be much happier for it. But otherwise, better luck on the next one, I hope.
Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think you're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is not my radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 63 of Nerd Pride Radio. I was going to tell you that 63 is the number of chromosomes in a mule, an odd number since it's an interspecies mix. But then I saw that 63 was the number of groats in a guinea. Hawa? Yeah. Okay, I vaguely know some of old-style British currency, like, all right, there's 20 shillings in a pound, I know that, and there's 12 pennies or pence in a shilling. Okay, I got that. And then there's farthings, and I think it's like 8 farthings in a penny or 4 farthings in a penny, something like that, I don't remember. And then you can even do half farthings and quarter farthings and all that. But what the hell is a groat? And I don't even remember where guinea fits in. Alright, so I gotta go look it up. And hey, look. The guinea was originally a fixed weight of gold worth 1 British pound. So, nice standard, 1 pound, 1 guinea. Easy. But then the price of gold kept fluctuating, and so, you know, suddenly a guinea's only worth, you know, 12 shillings, or the guinea's worth 30 shillings, or the guinea, you know, it kept going up and down. And so finally, they decided that enough of this, the guinea needs a fixed set rate, let's just lay it down. So in 1816, they said, you know what? It should be worth exactly 21 shillings. Huh? Why would they not just make a guinea worth 20 shillings? It's worth exactly a pound, which is where it started. No. It's worth 21. And I'm sure there was some great political or financial reason for doing it at the time. Some special interest was motivating that, but it doesn't make any difference. So, the whole point then is, then a groat is simply a third of a shilling. A groat is just 4 pennies. That's all it is. It's a 4 penny coin that, thus, if when you do the math for that stupid 21 for the guinea, which is the one that's out of line, you wind up with 63 groats into a guinea. I keep mixing them all up. There's too many names to remember, and so I'm thinking to myself, I mean, because there's also, in addition to all of these, there was also a florin, which was worth 2 shillings, a crown, which was worth, I think, 5? I think it was a quarter of a pound? I don't remember. And all of this seems weird with all the names, the groats and the farthings and the florins and the crown. But, you know, once you think about it, it's no worse than, you know, penny, nickel, dime, quarter. It's just names we give to coins. Or if you want to be Canadian, penny, nickel, dime, quarter, loonie and toonie, that's pretty good. So, you know, anyway, It's the groat, and the groat is worth, is there, oh, see, I screwed it up. This is going to be my nice little final for this bit. Groat, 63 groats to a guinea. There you go. There's my conversion rate. Never forget that. Anyway, enough of that. Ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a D&D D&D/Pathfinder Nerd. I gotta write that down. I've just been remembering to say it for the last 10 episodes. D&D/Pathfinder Nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, gaming nerd, science nerd, plus there's like 7 other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is a place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. Our sponsor this week, Nerd Pride Radio. I am so proud to have them on board. It is awesome. They've got a great website. You should go check it out. I think it's at nerdprideradio.com. And I believe they also have a podcast. I haven't listened yet. But right on to the meticulously plotted portion of our podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I pull out my pocket mod and I add that item to my master list, and the best stuff off of that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. In fact, I carry my pocket mod with me at all times, and I always have a pen in my pocket. I am always ready. We were at the pumpkin patch. I mentioned that last week. I didn't go into a lot of details, but we were in the pumpkin patch a week ago, and the pumpkin patch is this huge affair over near Omaha, actually near Gretna, but anyway, doesn't matter. And it's called Valla's Pumpkin Patch, and the thing is massive. I mean, they're only open for like the 1 month out of the year, maybe 6 weeks out of the year. I don't know what their full schedule is. But they must have 200 staff members on site. It is massive. It's this huge festival, carnival-style atmosphere. And so there's some games, but there's the huge corn maze, and there's the underground pirate maze in the dark, and there's, paintball guns, and there's the water balloon slingshot things, and there's food stands everywhere, and live entertainment all over the place. It was unreal. It was like going to the Renaissance Festival, except pumpkin-themed. And so we had a good time. And so while I'm there, I'm sitting down watching the mechanical dragon huge, like a full-size dragon, shoulders and neck and head. And this mechanical dragon reaches down and picks up pumpkins and then crushes them and sprays stuff everywhere. And he's really cool. And I'm like, oh, my God, I really need to write this stuff down. And so I go to pull out my pocket mod, and I'm like, well, wait, I have this stupid map flyer thing in my hand that, oh, by the way, the map isn't really the map of this area, and so therefore it doesn't help me at all. And so I took my little flyer, and I folded myself a new pocket mod and added my stuff to it. And now I have two pocket mods in my pocket. I'm like, hey, this is really convenient. This way I don't have to mix up my shopping list pocket mod and my things to do list stuff, and all that goes on one. And then my master list and my gaming stuff and my other notes for myself, they all go in the other pocket mod. I just keep two at the same time. That way, when I filled the one up with shopping lists, I don't have to sit there and copy over my whole master list into a new pocket mod. I can just keep this thing around forever. This is great. So, or at least until I use up all the items off of it. So, anyway, I love my pocket mods. Sorry. Complete diversion. That wasn't even on the master list. The first thing on the master list, updates! My only update this week is my weight. Last week I told you I was up 4 pounds because of that stupid pumpkin patch and my meetings in Lincoln, and I was just lazy and stupid. I used that as an excuse to just pig out. And now this week I'm down 8 from that. Holy crap. 8 pounds in five days. I recorded on Sunday last week. So 5 days? That's crazy. So it must have been all water weight and bloat and who knows what. But here's my secret. I am going to, based on 4 days of evidence, I am going to attribute my weight loss miracle to beef and barley soup. There you go. That's the magic. That's the one food that you eat for the rest of your life and lose all the weight you want. Clearly magic works. We made up some beef and barley soup Sunday night, and it was spectacular. Or Monday? I don't remember. It doesn't matter. Spectacular. I've never had beef barley soup because, well, where the hell do you find barley, right? It turns out my grocery store does have it. I think it's Quaker barley. And it's right there next to the soup stuff. But I wound up going to a health food store to find it because I couldn't find it in my supermarket. I looked all over. I asked somebody, and they're like, barley? Barley? Are you sure? They were no help. And so I wound up buying some at the health food store. This soup is incredible. Do you guys want the recipe? Should I even waste? Yeah, you know what? I'll give you the recipe real quick. Because it's super easy. 2 pounds of stew meat, a cup and a half of pearl barley, which, like I say, you can, at least in my grocery store, you buy it right next to the soup stuff in that same aisle. Pearl barley, that just means that the outer hard shell has been removed. So a cup and a half of the pearl barley, and then I think it's 2 quarts of beef broth, and I use beef stock instead of broth just because stock, especially for soups, has that kind of richer umami flavor. I hate saying umami, but it's a richer flavor for soups, so I like using the stock. And then you throw in, chop up some onions to pitch in there, and, oh, darn it, I wish I had looked up the spices. And it is salt and pepper and whatever you're going to throw in. It's real basic stuff. You don't have to do anything complicated at all. And then take a little bag of the baby carrots and just cut them into quarters. So I cut them once lengthwise, once across, so you got 4 pieces from each carrot, and just pitch them all in. Pitch everything into a big crock pot or slow cooker if you prefer not to use name brands. But pitch all that stuff into your slow cooker for the day, and 8-9 hours later, you come home, and you're just about ready to eat. You throw in a small bag of frozen corn and a small bag of frozen peas, and then you wait 15 minutes, it's all hot and ready, eat. It's beautiful. Okay. Now, having done that, we then had so much left over. I mean, even with my huge family, we had tons of leftover. So, I just bagged it up and froze it, and it's been working as lunches. So I've been eating beef barley soup for lunch every single day, and magically, I'm losing like 2 pounds a day. So clearly, this will work for everybody all the time. You guys have to do this. It's amazing. I'm thinking I've only got like 1 serving of soup left, and so I'm thinking that maybe Columbus Day, I've got the day off, and my whole family's at school, and they're gone, so I got nothing else to do all day. You know, I'll do some cleaning, I'll do some game stuff, and then I may just go ahead and make myself another batch of beef barley soup just to put away for lunches, not even to have for supper. It'd be awesome. I can't tell you how much I love beef barley soup. It's really good. Now it's time for a Nerd Culture Report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, Gonzo, but you are very, very close. I got a new podcast to listen to. Oh, I'm so excited. I hope they keep going. A friend of mine, Pat, my dungeon master, sends me a message asking if it's okay. He says, me and my friends have a new podcast, and I'd kind of like to post up about it on your site to get a little advertising for it. Is that all right? He was sweet enough to ask permission. How cool is that? It turns out that I don't care. I love anything. Go ahead. I'm perfectly happy because to me, yeah, and I get where he's coming from. He's like, well, you know, this is a website about your podcast, and therefore, do you really want another podcast advertising for itself on your space? And I'm like, I don't care because one, you're my friend, and two, you know what? It's not about competition. I posted this up on the boards too, but it's, to me, there's no, you know, the success of one podcast really is not detracting from me at all. I hope he does well, especially since I got a chance to listen to it. But more on that in just a second. I know technically, you know, there's only so many hours in a day, and so therefore, if you're listening to X number of podcasts, you know, you don't have enough time for more. But I don't think most people operate that way. I don't think most people are hunting around to find enough podcasts to fill all their waking hours, and therefore, when it gets to be too much, well, I guess, you know, if I like this new one, I'm going to have to drop somebody else. I don't think it comes down to that. I think for most people, some people it is, but I think for most people, they find the podcasts they like, and if they like them, they'll make time for them. And so therefore, yeah, it's not hurting me. I love having them on board. I think this is awesome. But enough of that babbling. The podcast is called Me Like Trivia. It's a trivia podcast, and it is DM Darks, my friend Pat, my dungeon master, Pat, and a couple of his friends, Andrew and Pete, and they do trivia night, just like going down to your local bar and having trivia night there. They're doing it on a podcast, and at least all I've seen is episode 1, because that's all they've given us, and at least from episode 1, it appears that the format is Pete is our moderator, our announcer, whatever you call him, and he's going to ask 50 questions or 45, I don't remember the number, and he's going to ask all these trivia questions, and then Pat and Andrew work together to come up with answers, and they did really well. It was entertaining as all get out. And all right, and how do I know? Because I kept yelling at my Kindle whenever anything, the question comes up, and I'm immediately shouting answers. I'm like, bat, it's twinkle, twinkle, little bat. What? And when they get something wrong, no, you're thinking of the wrong, no, that's Jennifer Beals. You're thinking of Jennifer, oh, God. It got me worked up. I enjoyed the crap out of it. They've got a great balance, of, you know, they've got questions and they fit in, you know, it's less than an hour for this podcast. And in less than an hour, they managed to get in all 45 or 50. Oh, hold on a second. Okay, where was I? Oh, I was talking about, they got all the questions in, 45, 50 questions, got all the questions in under an hour, and yet also had time to make jokes about a lot of stuff, the way you'll do when buddies get together and talk about anything. And it was really funny stuff, clever, and enough time to go, you know, take a couple of sidetracks off of some of the topics and have little discussions here and there, and it was just a good mix. I was just so thoroughly entertained by the whole thing that I can't get enough. I really am excited. And they're just starting out. This is episode one. They're planning on doing an episode of trivia like we just got, and then they'll follow up with a shorter episode that gives, you know, discussion on, you know, the stuff that they got wrong, where they really screwed up, have just a feedback session for each one, and then the number three, so the odd numbers, I don't have the number, the odd numbers will be the trivia ones, and then the even numbers will be the follow-up. And he's saying maybe, you know, once a month, twice a month, God, I hope it's more than that, because it's really, really fun. So I encourage you to go search for the podcast Me Like Trivia, and my searches were fruitless because it's brand new and it didn't turn up on my podcast searches. However, if you go to my website, there are two different threads, one in the Nerd Love section, one in the Nerd Talk section, two different threads about the Me Like Trivia podcast. So go find one of those and find the link to their feed and download it and listen to it, because it's really, really good, and you will thank me later. Enough of that. MetaTalk, why is that still on my list?
Oppenheimer!
Okay, I have no idea why it's here, but MetaTalk's where I pull back the curtain and talk about the podcast and the website a little bit. Things are going really well. You guys are responding well. You're giving me some great podomatics. I'm getting, suddenly the last couple of weeks, I must have sounded pathetic last time I begged for entries, because you guys have been giving me not the huge long lists, but I'm getting just like 4 or 10 really thoughtful questions all at once, and they're really cool. I'm so excited about the questions we're getting. I can't wait for Podomatic today. And yet I've got so much junk here, who knows how much time we'll have. So you guys are doing, my microphone's leaning. I should talk about that too. My microphone is wounded. I'm gonna have to finally order a new one. The leg broke off of my stand, one of the legs. Is the little tripod stand. And one of the legs broke off. And so I glued it back on. Super glue. Worked great. Not a big deal. And then my kids wound up dumping all of my stuff off that they were getting paper out or who knows what. And they dumped all my stuff onto the floor, and someone wound up stepping on the microphone again, broke that same leg off. And so I fixed it again, and now this time it's so weak it broke really easily. So I've got it glued again, but it's not really sturdy anymore. And in addition to the glue, I've also just bound it up with white duct tape. I did that just before I started working now, because that was the duct tape I had, was white. So it looks like it has been bandaged up. It is like a mummy. It's my Frankenstein microphone. My Frankenphone, if you will. Or, well, okay, that sounds like Frankenstein got himself a Verizon plan, but, my Mikenstein? No, because I'm Mike. Either way, this my poor zombie microphone is not going to last much longer. I'm going to have to get myself a new stand. That's too bad. But yeah, $26. This thing has been great for me for 4 years. I shouldn't complain. And plus, even then, you know, I can buy a whole new, I've been meaning to get two microphones anyway. Get myself one of the little mixers, or just get an MP3 recorder and do it on there. And then have two microphones so I can do interviews and I can have people on. And maybe when I go to Gen Con next year, I can sit around with my friends and we can all talk at the same time and have a good time. I should ask. Well, anyway, doesn't make any difference. But I didn't really have any meta talk. I just must have accidentally forgot to delete it off the list. So let's move on to my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. role-playing games, video games, card games. If it fits on my gaming table, then I am here to share it with you. And I don't really have a whole lot to talk about except that we've been doing a lot of Pathfinder again. And for those of you who are new to the podcast or are not familiar with Pathfinder for whatever reason, Pathfinder is just the iteration of Dungeons and Dragons that I play. All right. Originally there was Dungeons and Dragons, and then lots and lots of other role-playing games have come out. They're all pen and paper tabletop role-playing games where you sit down and everybody plays characters and you tell a story together in a game. Great. That's what we do. And Pathfinder is just the version of it that I play. Dungeons and Dragons went off in a different direction, Paizo took the third edition Dungeons and Dragons rules, revamped them, ran in their own direction so that we could continue playing the game that we really loved in that third edition style, while D&D can continue doing whatever it wants as it keeps updating. That's fine. But I love Pathfinder. Pathfinder's awesome. And, what have I done lately? I played some more with my kids, and, nothing really exciting happened. We got started, and they're making their escape, from the town that they've kind of burned down, and unfortunately we only got to play literally like 20 minutes. We get set up, we start talking about they're on the road and they're meeting up with some people, and got interrupted and we had to quit, so didn't get to finish that one. I'll come back to it. And we played a weird half session last night for my other Pathfinder game, my big adult game with my character Dothan, and it's been odd. It's been a lot of drama in the group lately, and I don't want to go into a whole bunch of detail, but it's like we're having some problems with people agreeing because we don't get a whole lot of money in this game. As we're talking about, you know, making sure that we are getting as much money as we can, making sure we're dividing it up appropriately, setting down some ground rules, and so the more lawful character in the group decided that he would draw up a charter for us, because that's what lawful characters do. They're obsessive about that, and it was really well done. Brilliantly done charter. Beautiful. And then the younger and chaotic members of the group, like myself, basically went, yeah, okay, whatever, contract, sure, I guess, that's great. You know, we got some quibbles, but that's fine. But we did wind up naming our group, and I had to leave because we had a test to study for and stuff. I was just kind of in and out. But the name, when I left, we had settled on Troubleshooters, which was way better than the Heroes of Sandpoint, because that's just so pretentious. So we settled on the Troubleshooters, and they were leaning towards blue-level Troubleshooters, which I thought was hysterical but inappropriate, but I think we ended with just Troubleshooters. I haven't gone back to read the log, so I will find out. I guess I didn't really have a whole lot to talk about with my gaming table. Huh. Yeah, I should organize these things better, don't you think? Instead, what's up next?
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
That's right, my science corner. That music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. Holy crap, I had to pause there in the break to patch up the Meikenstein. My microphone was really about to tip over. I see where I forgot to brace it with my bandages. So, okay, I think it's going to be steady for the rest of the episode. But we'll find out. What's on my science core? Oh, all right. So my brother Kyle has started a series of threads where he asks science questions to the to the website, to the forums, and then waits for us to give answers and generate some interesting discussion. And he's taking a break because I think he's got to be out of town all next week. But he was asking about interstellar travel and basically saying, do you ever think it's really going to happen? I mean, honestly, you know, the survival of humanity ultimately will depend on us getting off of this planet and making our way out into space. But since, you know, human civilization has really only been around, you know, 10,000 years, Is it realistic to think that we'll be, you know, that's just such a brief blink of time. Is it realistic to think that we'll actually make it off this planet? Do you think anyone will ever be willing to make that leap out to the stars, thinking that it might take thousands and thousands of years to get somewhere? Is anyone willing to take that chance? Is anyone going to make the move? My answer, and there's some good talk in there, but my answer on this one was, I think we will. I actually think that someday humankind, or whatever beings are the direct descendants and followers of humankind, I think we'll make it to other stars. I think we'll be there at some point. And here's why. And this goes back to a way earlier episode, but there is something out there called, I think it's called the 100-Year Project, which basically, or 100-Year Space Project, I can't remember what it is, but started by a former astronaut, and looking at the idea that you know, in the next 100 years, we need to develop the technology, the background needed to actually travel long distances in space. That we should actually, in the next 100 years, set up everything that we would need to make that kind of journey to another star. You know, figure out the technology involved in it. And they're dead serious about it, too. They're making a real swing at this. And for me, first off, the simple fact that we have people who are taking that seriously and putting actual money into it means that we will probably always have people taking that seriously and putting money into it. This is something that, I mean, humanity wants to do this, and there will always be that niche group that wants to make that happen. And so, you know, just like, what's his name, Branson, who puts all the money into space travel, and, you know, that's not something he needs to do, but he's, you know, immensely wealthy, and therefore, wants to do that. Richard Branson, that's who I'm thinking of. Is he the guy that does the space travel stuff? The SpaceX? I can't remember. Anyway, I think we'll always have people, benefactors like that who are pushing us towards space. And part of what you read with this 100-year project, if that's even the correct name. I should pause and go look it up. Not gonna. It's not as outrageous as we seem to think, or as a lot of people seem to think. Because, all right, first off, our biggest challenge is just figuring out how humans can survive in space for long periods. It's not even the travel, it's not the time involved, not anything, just how do we survive in space? A human being who, let's assume we have a human being born in space, living their entire life in space, dying in space, living to the ripe old age of 150 or 180 or however long we live in that particular time period, or forever for that matter. What do we need to do to make sure that human beings can survive in space indefinitely? All right, because right now we spend too long in space and our bones and muscles atrophy, which is horrible. But you know, I think that's just a lack of gravity. I think that can be fixed once we have big enough ships that you can actually have a permanent sort of artificial gravity set up. I mean, probably just by simple rotation, just centrifugal force sticking to the walls. But once we eventually get that, then, you know, your circulation can work the way it's supposed to. Your bones and muscles will actually have the stress of having to support itself against an accelerative force in order to keep your body normally healthy. Or possibly we just genetically engineer ourselves so that our body no longer needs to go through all that. But I think that's right now a little more complex than what we have the abilities for. But that might come someday too. Is the radiation from space. Look, simply being in space, you don't have the Earth's atmosphere and magnetic field to protect you from cosmic radiation. And thus, you're gonna wind up getting cancer if you live in space for too long. You're gonna wind up dying of radiation in space. It just is gonna happen. How do we protect ourselves from that long term? All right. How do we protect ourselves on that? Even for the 90-day trip to Mars, that's huge. You know, we're starting with a 90-day trip to Mars, but then later it'll be, you know, how do we do it for 2-year journeys out into further space, or 10-year journeys, or eventually lifetimes? That's the tougher part. I mean, look, we can come up with some kind of magnetic shielding. We've got plans that the living portions of your habitat will be surrounded by water, because water. A thick enough wall of water will help block stuff, or certainly, you know, lead-lined ships, or some other things that involve huge amounts of mass, huge amounts of weight that need to be taken into account. That's tough. That is really tough in space. That move, all that extra mass, I would hope for something simpler than that. I mean, can't we get, like, magnetic repulsor fields that mimic the job that Earth's magnetic field does? I don't know. I don't know what's possible. But that's going to be our toughest one. Our very toughest challenge, as far as I'm concerned, is just figuring out how we can survive the radiation. And again, it may take some genetic engineering. It may take the singularity where you can download your mind into a robot body or into a computer bank that runs the ship or into whatever. I mean, once we free ourselves from physical bodies and we can put ourselves into machines, then all bets are off. Then we can send ourselves anywhere. I mean, that's super easy because when you can do that, well, then the time period makes no difference. We're all effectively immortal. You can send yourself out into space and just shut down until you get to where you're going. And you can just, you know, make a copy of yourself and just send the copy, because then that way, if the copy dies, well, okay, sad for him, but, you know, I'm still here. It's fine. You know, in the copy, all that happens when he dies, he just never got switched back on. He doesn't know the difference. So, yeah, if we ever get to that level, and I have doubts about whether or not we can, once we get to that level, all bets are off. But in the meantime, how do we get just regular old flesh and blood meat human beings out into space? All right, let's conquer that part. But then, like I say, I think really, once we have that part done, we're going to make this trip to Mars, because Mars is such a huge, huge event, and everybody wants us to get to Mars. Well, not everybody, but you know, the people who are really, really hep on space travel see Mars as the next step. That's what I see as the next step. And trip to Mars with human beings, you know, may or may not be it's not the be-all, end-all. But it is a huge step, a huge, wonderful step we could take. And once we figure out how to do that, we get people that can go out there and hopefully return safely, and we make a couple of regular trips. Okay, now we can start building beyond that. Now it's a matter of, all right, not just can we go to the moon, can we go to Mars, can we get to other things in our solar system, make a trip up to a comet, make whatever we're going to do. Now it's, can we live there? Alright, once we've figured out that we can get ourselves there, then can we live there? Can we live, you know, for 15, 20, 30 years in, you know, mining habitats that orbit in the asteroid belt, and, you know, mining asteroids and comets and whatever else? Can we do that? And then once we can, you know, once we start inhabiting other areas of the solar system, then all bets are off. Then we can start spreading out. Then we can start, I have this vision. This is where my God's Dice game setting. I mean, God's Dice is just a game. I get that, but that was the vision I had for God's Dice. Is that once we beat that barrier, once we get to the point where we can survive in space indefinitely, then we can fill up the solar system. We can fill up the solar system and just go crazy. All right, I love that image in my head that we've got, you know, billions of human beings. You know, the masses of humanity living outside of Earth. I love that. Maybe I'm a dreamer. Okay. And then once we do that, once you've got people who are living in a habitat that circles the sun, and, you know, they have generations of beings that live and die there and never visit Earth even once, well, now it's a matter of, okay, can we take the next leap and say, all right, we can do that without having to be resupplied from Earth. You know, we can get everything we need from asteroids. We can get everything we need from the moons of Jupiter. We can get everything we need somewhere else. We don't need Earth to survive. All right, now we're safe for when the sun finally goes nova. You know, and it's a couple billion years in the future. Longer than that. I think it's 4 or 5 billion. How long before the Earth gets burned up by the sun? I don't know. Doesn't matter. But it means if we destroy our own planet, if everything on Earth fails, that's all right. It's not all right. It would be tragic and horrible. But we have the ability to survive beyond that, all right, at least in our solar system. Now can we get to the point where, okay, we can build a big enough ship, we can stock up enough, have all the supplies we need, find a way to resupply ourselves if we need to, and make the hop from here to Alpha Centauri, four light years away? I think we can. Because at 4 light years away, literally, reasonably, I think once we get the technology to be traveling around in space, once we can get speeds up, you know, I don't know what our maximum potential is going to be, obviously. We're not traveling around at light speed. We're not traveling around in warp drives, although that's a cool concept and there's real math for it, real science for it. Now, let's assume we're just traveling around in regular sub-light speed ships. You know, we can still make it to Alpha Centauri in 50 years, 80 years. It can be done. And that's, you know, once we've mastered living in space, that's not as huge a leap as one would think. So, yeah, I think we're going to get there. I think we're eventually going to have this diaspora where, yeah, the mass of humanity, you know, whether it's 8 billion people or 100 billion people, the mass of humanity is all going to live on Earth and in our solar system great, but we will send out just a few colonies. And if even, you know, 2, 3, 4 of them make it to some other star, they start the process over again at that star. Maybe they find a habitable planet, maybe they find a planet that they can terraform, or maybe they just reach that other star and they use its asteroids and comets and planets and whatever else they find. They use that for their resources and they continue to build habitats in space. I mean, but then the process starts over from there. That now we've achieved multiple star systems, and if the Earth goes, or if one other star system goes, we still have others, and there's still people out there. Anyway, this is just me doing my long fantasy, but I don't think it's all that far-fetched. I think this is something that is within the realm of possibility, and I think really, the challenge is, can we get ourselves to survive in space in the first place? And if so, can we get it done and get ourselves out there before we make our planet unlivable? Yeah, it's a race. Let's go. And maybe, hey, cheeriest scenario, maybe we don't make our planet uninhabitable. Maybe we don't burn out all of our resources and fry the atmosphere and, you know, whatever else. Maybe we find a way to fix our actions here on Earth and we wind up with a perfectly habitable planet for millions of years into the future, and we have a way to control and regulate that while we also continue exploring space. That would be even better, wouldn't it? All right. Anyway, I was fascinated by that thread. I wanted to talk about it. I've talked about it. Time to move on. That's right. It's my unnamed history segment. And this one is just cool. It is Poveglia Island. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Poveglia Island. I was looking online at a list of one of those clickbait lists, but it was the 25 amazing abandoned places you didn't know existed or some crap like that. Who knows what it was. But one of these was a picture of Poveglia Island. And it didn't come with a name. There was no label on it. It was just a picture to show what the island looked like. And, okay, hold on 2 seconds, because all of a sudden my notes are not where I needed them to be. Ah, here we go, I got it. Excuse me. All right, so I'm looking at Poveglia Island, and in this photo that I'm seeing, you're looking at, right in the foreground, an octagon. It's an island, I mean, it's completely surrounded by water, solid octagon with these big fort-like walls, like this huge, it's a fortress on this octagon. And once I got some scale to it, and I look at a map, this fortress is maybe about 150 feet across, but it's a perfect octagon, totally surrounded by water, and then literally right behind it in the picture, you go back maybe 15 feet, and there is another huge island behind it. And this island is kind of wedge-shaped, and the island, the big part of the island is maybe, 800 feet deep, maybe 600 feet wide, and it's kind of wedge-shaped so that it looks for all the world like a big candy corn that's kind of facing towards you. So this octagon at the front, that's the tip of your candy corn, the little white part, and then you've got the main part of the island right behind that, and then the last part, there's a canal that cuts off the back end of the island that cuts off the base of your candy corn, was that brown? No, what are they? It's like white, yellow, and orange. Is those the colors of a candy corn? Anyway, which, by the way, since it is season for candy corn, I gotta tell you, I love candy corn. I absolutely love candy corn. It is wonderful stuff, except here's the problem. I cannot own candy corn. If I buy a bag of candy corn, I can't stand it. If it's like sitting there in a bag on my desk or in my house, I have no urge to pick up candy corn and eat it if I own it. It's like I'll take a few and I'll go, oh, no, that's not as good as I remember. Never mind. But if I go into somebody else's office and they've got candy corn on their desk and I just steal 2 or 3 of them, stolen candy corn tastes awesome. Oh, my God. I don't know what it is about candy corn. I can't buy it. I can't own it. I mean, someone hearing that I love candy corn gave me a big bag of candy corn last year because I came in and I stole some off her desk. I'm like, oh, God, candy corn is so good. And then she wanted to give me a thank you for something or whatever. So she bought me a little bag of candy corn and I had it in my desk forever because I'm not going to eat it. I don't, It's no good when you've got it. It's just, it's really good when you steal it, though. I love candy corn when you steal it. So, anyway, and the more clandestine the stealing, if they don't know that you're taking their candy corn, it's even better. I mean, if you walk in and they say, oh, yeah, yeah, go ahead, help yourself. Eh, all right, it's still good, but not as good as if it's just completely stolen. The magic of candy corn. Anyway, Poveglia Island is, like I say, giant candy corn. The tip of it is 150 feet across, octagon fortress. Behind that, main portion of the island, which is covered in buildings of all sorts. And the buildings look like huge institutional style buildings. So clearly, I mean, I work in an old insane asylum. So I know an asylum when I see it, and that's exactly what this looks like, or maybe some old boarding school, or maybe who knows what it was. I do, because I've read the articles, and I'm going to tell you, but we'll get to that in a minute. And then behind that, there's that canal that cuts off the back part of the island. There's just a little bridge, footbridge, that you can go over to the back part of the island. And then the back part is just all trees. It's all woods and forest. And actually, the whole island is covered with lots of trees in the first place. The fortress part of it is completely overgrown. It doesn't appear that there's anything on it. But that middle part, yeah, has this huge campus. Well, not huge. I mean, again, I'm telling you, this portion is maybe a 600-foot or 500-foot square is the grand total size of this middle portion of the island. And so I'm like, that's abandoned? You're kidding with me. And so like I say, there was no name, no nothing on it. I didn't know it was Poveglia Island. I didn't know where it was. And so I did some image searches to see if I could match it up to anything. And finally, I found an article in another language. I don't know if it was Ukrainian or what I was looking at, but I picked out the name Poveglia Island. So I do a search for that. Sure enough, this is the place. It's in Italy. It's right off the coast of Venice, in Venice Harbor or Venice Lagoon, whatever that big, the big bay is in front of Venice. And it sits in there. And was originally used, darn it, I did it again. I keep moving pictures around. See, I hate this when I have to keep shuffling around my notes to find stuff. I wish I had condensed it all onto a single page because this kind of breaks the illusion. Normally, I just talk about stuff and you guys are under the impression, I'm sure, that I'm a complete genius, that I have this complete command of facts and stuff, when really the truth is, I can look a lot of things up. That's how Google makes us all smart people. Seriously. But Poveglia Island, off the coast of Italy, off Venice, first mentioned in 421, all right, when due to barbarian invasions, people from Padua were escaping there, and actually had a decent population for such a tiny little island, all the way up through, you know, the 9th and 10th century. And then it wound up coming under attack from Genoans, is what my note says. And they all moved off the island. And so the island remained uninhabited for like 200 or 300 years. It was offered to some monks who refused to take it over for whatever reason. But then, finally, in the year 1645, the Venetian government built a bunch of octagonal forts to protect Venice and control entrances to their lagoon. And one of those forts was right there, that fort, that octagonal fort that we see right there, at the candy corn tip of Poveglia Island. And so they were using it basically just as a military garrison, a naval fort to protect their waterway. That was all it was. So cool. And, the 18th century, 1776, in fact, our year of independence, it's coming under the jurisdiction of the Public Health Office. And so they're using it now as a checkpoint for goods coming in. It's an import-export. It's just basically, we no longer need the military protection so much as we need just a place to do paperwork and check people in and out and all of this. And it then became really relevant because, oh, hey, during the late 18th century, there was plague coming in on ships, and so therefore they started using it as, well, since this is where we're checking stuff in and out anyway, if you've got sick people on board, it now becomes our quarantine station. So the old military garrisons that they had, the buildings that they had built for the soldiers, they're now using to house quarantined sick people, all right? Also put up a lighthouse while they were at it, but the lighthouse is gone. Oh, wait, no. That was the church bell. And now the church bell's gone. They wound up getting rid of the church, but replaced it with a lighthouse. Anyway, they used it as a quarantine station until they finally decided that, hey, as long as we're housing people here and the quarantine is not nearly as important as it used to be, we're not having the masses of immigrants or people coming in and out that need to be quarantined, but we do have all these facilities for housing sick people, hey, why don't we put our crazy people there? And so sure enough, like I say, I first looked at it and went, oh, wow, that definitely looks like an asylum. And I know my asylums. And so sure enough, they started using it early 20th century, early 1900s. They started using it as an insane asylum. And they did that until 1968, when it was finally shut down for good. And in 60s and 70s were a great time for shutting down mental institutions. Again, I know what I'm talking about. Oh, my God. Because, look, the abuses that go on inside mental institutions, maybe you would believe it, maybe you wouldn't, but prior to the 70s especially, and even later than that for a lot of areas, but prior to the 70s, the abuses that went on inside insane asylums, institutions for the mentally ill, the mentally deficient, epileptics, hysterical women often got committed to institutions. The abuses that went on in institutional settings in those days were horrifying. Horrifying. This is completely off topic from Poveglia, but as long as I'm talking about it, I actually, when I was a social worker, all of my clients were mentally handicapped individuals. Some of them were severely mentally handicapped, so therefore nonverbal, couldn't take care of themselves, et cetera, but there were others who, they did pretty well on their own. They need someone to come in a couple hours a week and just make sure that their checkbook's in order and make sure that they're buying groceries appropriately, but otherwise they've got a minor job and they have some assistance and they live in their own place and they're doing fine. All right. So there's a wide range of clients I had, and some of my clients were ones who had been institutionalized, back in the 70s. And yeah, I did, my social work was in the 90s. So they would have been 20 years before I met them. They had been living in institutions, and some of them, Jim was one of my guys. Long since dead now. But Jim was one of my guys who was a sweet guy, and he wanted so badly to be liked, but he was so messed up from a lifetime of abuse. It was just tragic. And Jim was, if he hadn't been institutionalized when he was young, if he had had an actual education and real help, he wouldn't have needed any help as an adult. But as a child, he got shipped off to an institution and it just ruined him. And he would, he wasn't big on talking about it, but every once in a while, he'd come out about the kinds of things that went on in the institution, the isolation, the beatings, the rape, he would tell you everything that happened if you showed an interest, if you were asking. Yeah, he'd let you know. And it was horrifying for men and for women, and it was terrible. And so, because of that, a lot of these abuses in the United States, a lot of it came out during the 70s. That's when this particular institution he was in, that was when the abuses came to light. That finally someone spilled the beans on him, and it becomes a huge national scandal, and they wind up shutting places like this down. Each one that pops up, they're like, oh my God, we had no idea this was going on. It goes on in every institution. And then they shut the place down, and so Jim, along with a few other guys I worked with, got shipped out into community services, into places that could help them that weren't giant institutions. And so sure enough, Jim came out to live in our little town. And had a much better life from that point onward. And eventually that institution has reopened. The state put it back into service, and it still is serving mentally handicapped individuals, and I've been there a few times myself to visit, and it's actually a gorgeous place now. It's really, really nice, and things are different. Things are better. I'm sure, there's always stuff that goes wrong in places, but hopefully they're catching that and weeding it out fast when it does happen. But anyway, So again, 70s, great time to be shutting down institutions. Happened a lot. And so Paveglia Island, I don't know why they shut it down. I don't know what happened to it. But 1968, they shut it down. And so now, 1968, so for almost 50 years, this island has just been sitting completely unused. And, I mean, the buildings are huge and gorgeous. Now, obviously, after 50 years of disuse, they clearly are going to need some fixing up. But, oh, man, go do a search for Paveglia Island, because you know I'm not going to remember to put a link to it. This thing is amazing. I would love to go visit, love to hang out there and just look. The thing is crazy cool. And again, because of my love for institutional settings, I mean, look at, some of these interior shots are crazy. These ancient stone stairwells with wrought iron railings, and ivy growing through the stones and hanging down inside the building. Creepy as all hell at this point. I would love to visit there. I would love to set a horror movie there. I would love to set a role-playing game in that. That's, again, Pariah, the one game I wrote and published, outside of, you know, my own publishing. The only piece I've had published by somebody else, that's the words I was looking for, was set in an institution that was pretty much a physically the building's exact copy of the building I work in right now. But I would love to run a game inside of a setting like Paveglia Island, especially with the isolation, not just of being in an institution, but being in an institution on an island, out in the water, the isolation just increases, and to have that military fort right up front. And the fort is mostly itself gone now. It's all overgrown and green, and all you see is those original fort walls rising up out of the water. It's just crazy. So I love Paveglia Island. That's my piece of history for this week. So freaking cool. Oh, and Jim, by the way, I don't even know why I feel it's important to bring it up. Jim died when he was hit by a car, sadly. He was at a legal crosswalk. He was walking his bike across the street, and a dude coming up, I don't know, I mean, this was back in the 90s, so he probably wasn't texting, but I don't know if he was on his phone, I don't know if he wasn't paying attention, who knows what, but like I say, guy's crosswalking his bike, following all the rules, walking his bike across the street at a legal crosswalk with a light, and dude just totally didn't look and just smacked right into him. It was horrible. And, I mean, by the time I got up to the hospital, he was already unconscious and, lasted maybe another hour, and then that was it. It was sad. But, he was a nice guy. Really nice guy. But, again, hey, I'm not here to depress you. I'm here to be awesome, and so that means we're done with the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast, and it is time for the Pod-O-Matic! Sweet! Let me get rid of Paveglia Island and take a look at my notes again so that I can say, hot dog, this is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Well, where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on my forums. I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. This is awesome. R2 has given me a 25, and that means that we have a question from Zimney. And Zimney says, if you could sing one song on American Idol, what would it be? I would sing One More Minute by Weird Al. I talked about karaoke last week. I told you how much I love some of these songs. I would sing One More Minute by Weird Al, and I would sing it badly, but I would sing it with so much passion and emotion that I would become the joke of the week contestant, and I would get all sorts of airtime and play because I'm that bad but that sincere about my song. It would be awesome. 25. What is... I think it's R2 himself is in there wedged up under one of the dice. Let's try this again. There we go. 21. 21 is from Zimney again. Hey, Zim. Zim says, you're in a game, and an NPC tells you, stay out of Squid Town after dark. Do you heed this warning? Hell no. Stay out of Squid Town after dark? Are you out of your mind? I am a hero. I am an adventurer. I mean, I'm not, I might ask why first, you know, and maybe if the answer is because the town bursts into flame every night and I can see that from a distance and realize that he's telling the truth, all right, maybe I'll listen, but really, stay after Squid Town after dark, you're inviting me in. That's where the cash is going to be because that's where the action is. Oh, of course I'm going into Squid Town. Oh, two. That is cool. Number two, hey, it's from Humongous. And Humongous says, new Total Recall or original Total Recall? Oh, dude, original Total Recall by a long shot. Do you know how much I love that movie? Do you know how many times I've seen original Total Recall? And do you know how much I've noticed that the special effects really kind of suck now? I mean, they're really horrible special effects. And I don't care at all because that is a great story. Oh, come on. I mean, you know, three-breasted hooker, midget hooker, Quato coming out of the guy. This is an awesome movie. I love the whole mind game aspect of it. I love getting to watch this whole movie and question what's real and what's not real and if it's all in his head. I think it's amazing. I fell in love with that movie the first time I saw it, and I've gotten the same appreciation out of it every single time. Love that film. The new Total Recall is an okay action film. It's not the horror fest that everyone thought it was. I mean, everyone's talking, when I say horror fest, I don't mean a horror movie, I mean horrible. A horrible film. Reviewers hated it, people hated it. I'm like, nah, it's alright. It's not bad. It's got some good performances. It's got a decent story to it, I suppose. But ultimately, it had no fun. I mean, if you're gonna redo Total Recall, Total Recall was a fun movie. And Total Recall was really all about the mind games. And it was about Mars, damn you. Why am I not on Mars in the new movie? Yeah, no, you really lost me on that one. Really lost me. 72. Let's roll down the page. To Humongous again. Way to dominate. Humongous says, did you notice in the movie Prometheus that the auto dock in the cabin of Meredith Vickers was not set for a female? Does this indicate that she was transgender? No. I did not notice that. I remember Prometheus, and I remember not liking it much because it was really dumb. You know what? I say lots of movies are dumb and I like them anyway. But this was dumb in a bad way. And I did not enjoy this movie, Prometheus, at all. But which one was Meredith Vickers? Was that the main hero, or was that the daughter of the guy that, hold on, let me go look. Google is my friend, right? Or in this case, IMDb. So, IMDb, you know, I have shortcuts for stuff, and yet, it's so much easier to just type in the first two letters and go straight to it. Alright. IMDb. Prometheus. There it is. And let's see. Yeah, what a horrible, horrible prequel of a movie. That thing could have been so spectacular, and it just wasn't. I just don't remember enough of it. Meredith Vickers. Oh, yeah, that was Charlize Theron. It might indicate that she was transgender. It might indicate that she was a hermaphrodite. It might indicate that the writers were just lazy and didn't pay much attention. I don't know. If that's actually true, why would you introduce a transgender character in such a subtle way and not have it mean anything to the film? I mean, this is Chekhov's genitals, right? You know, if you're going to point out that someone is transgender in a film, then you really need to bring that back into play, or else you're just introducing extraneous information that doesn't forward your plot. I got nothing on this one. I don't remember enough of the movie to really comment on it, but okay, I'll give it to you. Maybe, but probably not. I don't think they were that clever. I think, honestly, it was probably just an error at some point that they were reusing a prop from someone else's set and then forgot to reset it or forgot to change that aspect of it. That would be my best guess, but who knows. 71. Right next to 72. 71, also from Humongous, holy crap. Frazetta or Vallejo? I assume it's pronounced Vallejo. Okay, this is Frank Frazetta and something Vallejo. I think it's Boris. I'm not even going to look it up. I think it's Boris Vallejo, but that sounds a little odd, and so I'm afraid of saying it for looking stupid. But Frank Frazetta versus Boris Vallejo. All right, these guys are both, for those who don't know, these guys are both fantasy artists, well-known fantasy artists, actually. So when you see your classic, like a Conan the Barbarian cover kind of thing is what you're looking at. When you see the barbarian struggling against the giant snake, or when you see the female warrior in her chainmail bikini, or in no clothes whatsoever, battling, you know, a horde of goblins or whatever it is that they fight. Probably not goblins, they're too small. It would have to be something bigger and more dramatic. But that classic fantasy style cover, that thing that I, in my mind, associate with the heavy metal covers at times. I don't know if any either of them ever did anything for heavy metal, but I associate it with that. Classic 60s and 70s fantasy art. Is that when they were? 70s maybe? That kind of stuff. Maybe even before that. That's who these guys are. And between the two of them, I have always preferred Frank Frazetta. Just his, I mean, go out and look. Just go do a Google image search for the two of them, and Frank Frazetta's artwork is just more gritty, more real, more, I mean, Boris Vallejo does the scenes, he has the elements there, and yet, whenever I look at a Boris Vallejo, picture, it's like a romance cover for, like, you know, the historical romances and stuff. It's like that should be Fabio on there. It's like they've taken some, you know, bronzed model and then just slapped some fantasy elements around that model to make it look like a fantasy. Like, the women look like, they just look like models. They look like models from the 70s or 80s just posing for a picture. They don't look like they're actual characters in the fantasy. That's to my mind. In fact, you know what? Let's go ahead and pull it up. And back to Google. Google's my friend. Google Image Search. That's the one I do use a link for. I have Google. I have Google Image. And let's go Frank Frazetta. Oh, look at that. I'm doing a search for Frank Frazetta. And the first option in Google says Frank Frazetta Conan. Frank Frazetta, John Carter? Okay, so when I said, like a Conan, okay, apparently he did Conan covers, that's why I associated it with Conan. Silly me. Okay, yeah, I'm looking at some Frank Frazetta pictures, and, oh man, see, these are fantastic. I mean, they're kind of cheesy, they're kind of old, but these are people who look just gritty and mean and tough. I mean, the hair is wild. The muscles are straining and pulling. These are, God, I've got one. All right, I've got a human barbarian warrior. He is wearing nothing but a loincloth and a Viking helmet, wielding a huge double-bladed axe, and he is pulling, it looks like a bar fight. He's standing on a table and he's pulling up guys, and everyone in this picture looks crazed and mean, and every muscle is straining and pulling. This is really cool. All right, now, let's compare that to, let's see if I can find anything similar for Vallejo. Vallejo. I don't even know how to spell it. Hold on, let's see if it is Boris. Oh, it is Boris. Once you type in Boris V, you get Vallejo. Ooh, but Boris Vallejo also has Marvel, Conan, Mermaid, Dragon Art. Okay, hold on. Let's see what Boris Vallejo gives us. Boris Vallejo, alright, I'm looking for a scene similar to the one that I just saw. And of course, also, this is just the images that are showing up when I do a search for the name. So for all I know, maybe some of these aren't even real. Oh my god, that one's horrible. Oh look, I'm assuming this is Hercules. Hercules battling Cerberus, and oh Jesus, that's bad. That's really bad. Hercules, literally, I mean, it is it looks like Mr. Universe flexing his muscles. It looks like Schwarzenegger's body in one of the classic flex poses that the Mr. Universe guys do. And his face is very 70s, 70s feathered hair, 70s beard and mustache, and he looks bored. I mean, he's got this flex pose, he's got his hands digging into the collar of Cerberus on one head and holding his jaws open on the other head, with a third one snapping back at him, and yet he looks bored out of his mind. This is terrible. This is a terrible piece of art. Alright. And that's exactly the kind of stuff I was talking about. This is just bad. Do your own searches. Actually find, and again, because when I look at the Boris Vallejo page versus the Frank Frazetta page, a couple of the images are actually similar. Like, here's one that on the Boris Vallejo page, here's ones that I actually think looks pretty decent. And it looks like Conan, leaping down onto a dude. Okay, now that I get the close-up. Yeah, it is Conan, leaping down to knife an ape man in the back. And that part looks pretty cool. Conan looks pretty rough. He's tough. But then there's the naked chick in the background, and yeah, she's just a nude model posing in the background. But man, that Conan's pretty good. So, you know, not like he didn't do good stuff. But in comparison, you know, here's John Carter on Mars. Is that him? Yep, that's him. Yeah, this, at least I assume it's John Carter. Oh, it says The Prisoner. I don't know what that means. Yeah, this is, again, just a Mr. Universe dude flexing, and then we've now, while he's flexing, we draw him and then draw a gun in his hand and draw some monsters to face. The monsters are pretty cool. Some kind of lizard-like snake dragon sort of looking thing. Those are cool. But the dude, again, he looks a little annoyed and bored, but not at all invested in, he's about to have to shoot dragons in the face, and he could care less. Yeah, it's a different set of styles. So they're very similar. And I'm sure Frank Frazetta has done some crappy stuff, and I'm sure Boris Vallejo has done some really good stuff. But on the whole, yes, Preparation H does feel good on the whole. I'm sorry, Austin Powers joke. I'm sorry. I don't even know what my problem is. but on, I can never say the phrase on the whole without thinking of that joke. I'm sorry, let me get myself together. But on the whole, I don't like Boris Vallejo's work as much as I like Frank Frazetta's, and both of them look a little old-fashioned, but when you look at the artistry that went into them, Frazetta's stuff is just clearly better. I've spent way too much time on this topic. I don't know that this deserved that much, but I found it fascinating. That was an awesome question, Humongous. Seriously. Let's go down to 73. All right. 73 is my 7 stuck? Is that why we're doing this? I'm going to have to buy some smaller dice. I really, really need to. This one is from Kyle. Kyle says, Nerd fight! Andy Dick versus Jeff Hawes. Who wins? And please, don't undervalue the strength of Crazy in your analysis. All right, look, I don't care how much strength you're giving to Crazy. Jeff is just not going to be able to pull this out. I'm kidding, Jeff. I don't know which way he meant the Crazy, but I would assume it's on the Andy Dick side. Because Andy Dick's Crazy is in, manic drug-fueled hysteria, which I personally think on pure skill, I think Jeff Hawes would have it. I honestly think Jeff could take him down in a straight-up fight, but the problem is that because of the Crazy, I don't think Andy Dick gives a crap about nothing. I think he is immune to pain and immune to the consequences of his actions, and I just see him just flying full force into it. Consequences be damned. And, dude, that is some scary stuff. I'm going to have to give this one to Andy Dick. I'm sorry, Jeff. I love you, but dude, he's a crazed drug-fueled celebrity. What are you going to do? Sweet 68. I only got off that damn 7. 68 is from Ronster. Hey, Ron. Ronster says, Dragon Magazine. Did you ever subscribe to it? Oh my god, speaking of Frazetta and Vallejo artwork, of course I subscribe to Dragon Magazine. I don't know that either of those guys' art was ever used on Dragon Magazine, but that should have been the example I used. When you think of classic fantasy art from Frazetta and Vallejo, who, now that I've seen that they did Conan stuff, maybe they were a lot earlier than the 60s or 70s I was thinking. Doesn't matter. Dragon Magazine exemplified that style, and especially now that I think back on it, Dragon Magazine was probably not the best examples of that style of fantasy art. There, I remember some really good covers, but I also remember some really stupid, cheesy covers where it was clearly just some paid nude model who's in some very provocative pose, and then we surround her with a dragon and some revealing armor and God knows what else. Dragon had a lot of good and a lot of bad for the cover art. But yes, I subscribed to Dragon Magazine for years. I mean, actually subscribed to for many years. And then I subscribed to it again, because I took a long break, through college years and my early marriage. And then finally got to the point where I'm like, you know what? I love D&D. I need to get back to this. Oh my god, Dragon Magazine's still out. And I got a subscription to it again, and it was published by Paizo. And that was actually Paizo's instigation to change and start publishing Pathfinder came when Wizards of the Coast, Hasbro, the people that own Dungeons & Dragons, said, look, we're going to go in a different direction. We don't need Dragon Magazine anymore. We're going a totally different way, so you guys can stop. And so Paizo lost their contract to make Dragon Magazine, which they loved, I loved, and instead decided that, okay, well, if we can't do that, what can we create? And so they decided to create their own content, and, well, okay, if we're creating our own content, we're going to need to maintain the game that goes with it, so they created their own game to go with it. It was actually ultimately wound up being in everyone's best interest, because Paizo now is making way more money than they ever did just being support for someone else's game. So, good for them. I mean, I'm glad it worked out. That is 82. 82 is from Zimny again. Alright, Zim, what you got for me? What is the largest type of big cat in the world? It is the liger. The liger is the largest big cat in the world. Something about crossing a lion with a tiger. And specifically, a liger is not just a cross between a lion and a tiger, but it has to be, specifically, the father is the tiger and the mother is the lion, or vice versa, but it has to be a specific combination. And then what happens is, certain elements that are supposed to limit their growth hormones just aren't switched on properly, and so therefore the liger grows larger than either parent and winds up being the largest big cat, on Earth. And sadly, you know, it's a liger, so like the mule with its 63 chromosomes, the liger, is sterile and therefore does not interbreed. So it's not a true breed of big cat, but it is the largest big cat in the world. Oh god, I should have come up with, darn it, I should have found an alternate use of the word cat and made a joke on that, but I totally missed it. Too late. 99! I am all the way down. 99 is from Kyle. Kyle says, have you seen Warehouse 13? Have I seen Warehouse 13? Oh my, it's on Netflix Instant Watch, and I'm almost done with season 2. It's awesome. Awesome! Those are Kyle's words. It's the tongue-in-cheek humor of Buffy or Firefly, but with a Men in Black sci-fi tech to it. So awesome, says my brother Kyle. I could not agree more. I know there's something wrong with this show. I understand that. I mean, I want to look at it and go, oh, this is bad writing. I want to look at it and say, wow, this is dumb science. Oh, this is really, oh, the logic doesn't even bear up on, and yet, I don't care about any of that. The characters are amazing. I love every character in it. I love the snappy dialogue. I love the sci-fi concepts, because it's not about whether or not it's plausible, because none of it is plausible. There's not a single bit of it that is gorgeous magic dressed up as science. There's something so beautiful about it that everything in it is clearly magic, and there's nothing, you can't even make it vaguely plausible without calling it magic. and yet they never call it magic. They try and come up with sciencey ways that this is really plausible. They try and make science explanations that would actually account for this. It doesn't fly, and you have to decide from episode one that you don't give a crap. Because it's just, it's fun. I really, really enjoy that show. I think, what is it, 3 seasons are on Netflix, or is it only 2? Whichever, I think it's 3, but whichever one it is, I've watched every episode that's available on Netflix Instant Watch, and I'm waiting for the next season to become available because I just enjoy. I enjoy watching Warehouse 13. It's a great, great show. And I'm in love with Claudia. She's my next girlfriend. Really. I mean, look, again, I don't want anything bad to happen to my family. But if by some horrible twist of fate, my family were to die in some terrible, tornado accident that was totally unrelated to me, and I was available, and Claudia, the character, not the actress, Claudia, the character from Warehouse 13, again, I'm sure the actress is a perfectly sweet, wonderful woman, but if the character of Claudia were to be a real-life person and there was a chance we could get together, I would certainly pursue that, because she's awesome. All right. Oh, back to the sevens. We're at 70. And number 70 says, Zimnipot. Zimny asks, do you have a cool idea for an Ancient Aliens episode? No. No, I do not. How dare you? Oh, you and your Swedish wit. You think you're funny, right? Okay. I hate Ancient Aliens. That show is terrible. That show, Ancient Aliens, is on the History Channel. I don't even know if it's on the History Channel anymore because I'll never watch the History Channel. No, on the History Channel, and they present Ancient Aliens. Every episode about different theories about how aliens interacted with our ancestors and all the different artifacts that they could have created and all of the, on the History Channel, as if that's history, you people piss me off. How dare you? How dare you assault knowledge with your lies, your cheap, crass commercialism? You guys are horrible, horrible people. Oh, you should know better. So no, I have absolutely no ideas whatsoever for an Ancient Aliens episode. Although, I mean, maybe, if I were to, well, no, not with aliens, though. I couldn't. I mean, there are great story ideas that would go in there, sure. I mean, you could do all sorts of great things with aliens visiting. I have, oh wait, you know what? Now that I think about it, but see, this wouldn't make an Ancient Aliens episode because that show is stupid. That show tries to pretend to be fact-based and it's not. But of course, I do have my God's Eye, no, not God's Eye, Woden's Eye, or Odin's Eye, my setting where, an ancient alien probe circling our solar system screws up, and the probe is supposed to be just observing, but instead it crash lands into Earth right around the year 1050 or so, and falls into the hands of Harald Hardrada, king of Norway, Harald the Hardass, and Harald the Hardass winds up learning all sorts of miraculous stuff from this, and then winds up thus conquering England in 1066 instead of getting his ass kicked. And thus Vikings wind up ruling the Earth and then taking to space. And then I have a whole setting, an entire role-playing game setting devoted to playing Vikings in space. I love that one. And that involves aliens visiting Earth, contacting Earth 1,000 years ago. But it's hardly material for an Ancient Aliens episode because I have absolutely no made-up, cooked-up evidence that I could possibly present to indicate that it actually happened, because we don't currently have Vikings in warships in space performing terrorist actions on the evil aliens. That's just, it doesn't exist. If I had that, then I could imagine that I could create an Ancient Aliens episode. Maybe. But hey, that brings us to the end of our Podomatic and the end of our episode, and thus the only thing left is for GLaDOS to give us a recap.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week, Weezer's In the Garage for my gaming table, Wonderful World by Sam Cooke. It's the history segment. I did Science. She Blinded Me with Science, as performed by William Shatner. And then that's all the ones I did. So all of these songs are available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. Enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review, as I've noticed some of you have been doing. Thank you so much. Or check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdpride radio. Stop at the Facebook page, click like, 9 seconds out of your busy day. You can do that for a buddy. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page, Instant Game, Animal Ball Melee, Sandbox Hill, 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, and I promise if you do that, I will actually respond to you. But to be totally honest, the very best way to talk to me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up there, you send me a message, we will hang out together, we'll be best friends for life, we'll have fun. All right, you guys still haven't named this segment for me, so this is the Mike's Nerd Pride Radio Happy Fun Time Unicorns and Butterflies segment of the show. Let's call it the My Listeners Have Betrayed Me episode of the show, segment of the show. I should get some theme music for My Listeners Betraying Me. Let's get that. But before every podcast, I start up my thread in the forums that says, hey, I'm recording, do you guys have anything to add? And so let's go ahead and close that down. I forgot to close it down last week. Post reply. Done. All right, and then let's see what everyone replied to me. This is your chance to get on the show with anything. I mean, yes, send me the Podomatics. I love the Podomatics. The Podomatic is the lifeblood of this show, and you guys all know it. But also, if you don't want to wait around for a Podomatic entry to get there, you can also just pop into this thread, I'll read off whatever you've got, or if it's a question, I'll answer a question. Doesn't matter to me. Let's start off with a lie I had. A lie I had right at the top says, what would Dothan have done, Dothan being my half-orc bard in Pathfinder, what would she have done if she had found out that Ilion is Liahead's character? Do I need any more explanation? No, that's the only names. Okay. Dothan is my half-orc bard. Ilion is a halfling warrior who has known my character since she was a baby. He's known my parents used to be an adventurer with them, blah, blah, blah. All right. So, and I refer to him as Uncle Ilion in the game. All right. So, what would Dothan have done if she had found out that Ilion was her dad instead of her uncle? Oh, my God. That would explain why I'm so short. That would be, if I was half orc, half halfling, that would explain my size, and explain why you're always being so creepily protective, I suppose. She would have freaked out, I'm sure. And, God, that would have been so cool. Wow, alright, hold on, he's still got more here. God, that's such a concept for me, though. I honestly thought about it, but in the end, I decided against it because, well, I'm not sure. Something about it felt wrong and limiting to Dothan as a character, which I really don't want to do. Well, that's very thoughtful of you, and I agree that something about it feels a little bit wrong, but that would have been fascinating. How soap opera drama can you get? God, that would have been so cool. I mean, I get why you didn't do it, and it's cool that you didn't do it, because I think the interplay we're getting with the relationship you had with my character's mother, I think all that is fascinating. And I really like where the story is going at the moment, but that would have been cool too. I would have gone with it either way. It would have been fine. Again, bizarre, but, Dothan would have flipped. Dothan would have flipped and probably wouldn't have talked to you for a while. I mean, she's pretty mercurial, and she winds up getting really angry, and she blows up, and she storms off in a huff, and then she winds up forgiving and coming back because she's ADHD, and she
doesn't hold a grudge that long, but this one she might have for a while. I mean, that's a lot to take in. But, I mean, eventually it would have been okay, and it would have made a cool story no matter what. But, boy, that would have been a tough one. After Aliyah had Akiva's here. And Akiva says, my school just had a brief, and in parentheses, 5 to 10 minute, brief lockdown that they said wasn't a drill. That's great. Oh, God, right in the middle of Akiva's question. Hold on, I have to pull this back up and pause. Sorry, that was Yancey wondering where the hell I am. I take a long lunch every Friday so I can record this podcast, and he's surprised. Anyway, Akiva says, we had a brief lockdown, a 10-minute lockdown, that they said wasn't a drill. And his question to me is, so what happened, Answer Man? And then he has the trademark symbol after that, so clearly he owns Answer Man. Dude, a 10-minute lockdown that wasn't a drill? I'm going to guess that they found either someone called in a threat or... No, probably not a threat. A threat would have been maybe evacuation, and it would have taken a lot longer. Or alternately, I was going to say suspicious package, but now the more I think about it, I will lay you even money that someone came into the school. Someone came into the school and was arguing with a staff member, probably the principal or vice principal. I don't know how big your school is. But was shouting at somebody or caused a ruckus and screamed threats of some sort. And so whoever the person was completely unreasonable and needed to be removed. Maybe it was even a student that needed to be removed. Maybe it was someone in a drug-addled haze. Maybe it was Andy Dick. But someone needed to be removed from the school. And so they ordered a lockdown because they didn't want anyone in the hallways until they could get this person out, whoever they were. And so either the police showed up and got them out, but because the lockdown was so quick, because it was only 10 minutes, I'm going to guess that the person voluntarily left when they found out the police were on their way. And then the police wound up having to be in pursuit, but then danger to you guys is over, lockdown's done. So I'm going to guess it was an angry, upset, irate, and in someone's opinion, potentially dangerous individual who needed to be removed, and thus you're on lockdown until they get out of the building. That's my guess. Let me know if I'm right, man, because I find that fascinating. Talvin says, this should probably be for the Potomatic, and he also has a trademark symbol. Yeah, my trademark. But name your favorite 80s music videos. Oh, damn you, we've just been talking about this. My favorite 80s music videos, I already put up Talking Heads' Once in a Lifetime video. I love Talking Heads' Once in a Lifetime. It was the very first video that I ever saw on MTV. And I didn't see it until 1982, and MTV started in 80 or 81, but we didn't have MTV where we lived until we moved to Papillion, Nebraska, and then when we were there, we got cable, and within 6 months of being there, they got MTV. And so that was the first video I saw, was Talking Heads doing Once in a Lifetime. I absolutely adored that. Yeah, it's hard for me to separate between, favorite videos and favorite songs. But I'm also gonna say, Safety Dance, Men Without Hats. I love that. I love the creepy, dancing Renaissance Festival dude with his creepy dancing midget jester partner. I just really enjoyed that, and I love that song. I still love that song. One Night in Bangkok is one of my favorite 80s songs, but I don't remember the video for it, so I can't list that as my favorite video. Okay, wait, I have a couple more. I will also say Madonna's Lucky Star. And these are actually crazy that you're asking me this, because I've actually looked at all of these videos in the last 2 weeks. I can't even remember why. But Madonna's Lucky Star, when I was 15, 1985, I saw Madonna performing Lucky Star in her video, and I had no idea who Madonna was, had never seen her before, and she was the sexiest human being I had ever seen in my life. I was stunned. And so I went back and I watched the video, and I'm sorry that I did. I watched it again, like, literally within the last week or so. And it turns out that I'm watching it now, and, okay, that 80s fashion, that I can't even remember what the boy toy fashion that she had at the time that she made popular, that was really edgy and alternative and hot at the time, has been made fun of to such a huge extent since then that it's hard to look at it and take it seriously. And I'm looking at her and it's Madonna. It's Madonna. She does, I mean, in the face, she still looks like Madonna. It's her. And so now knowing the whole history of Madonna and everything she's done since then, and I know who she is and what she's about and all this, it's hard to look at that, you know, 23, 25 year old girl that she was and get the same, that same sense of just raw sexuality coming out of that video. Like I said, when I was 15, that thing was amazing. Now, less so. So I'm, you know what? I watched it the one time, and now I've decided I'm never gonna look at that again because it doesn't live up. But that one was definitely up there for me. And then, Flock of Seagulls, Iran, that thing is iconic. And here's the amazing part about Flock of Seagulls and their video for Iran. If you haven't seen it in recent years at all, right now, in your head, get a picture of what Flock of Seagulls looks like. Alright? If you know Flock of Seagulls, then you know what I'm talking about. Picture their hairstyles. Picture what they're going to look like when you turn this video on. Alright? You've got it locked in your head. You know what they're going to look like, right? Okay. Okay. Now go watch the video. I'll wait. Go ahead. Yeah, do you see what I mean? That's not as bizarre as I remember. I mean, they're bizarre. They're weird looking. All right. Their hairstyles, their fashion sense, the dark haired dude with the big sunglasses who looks for all the world like a miniature version of Styles from Teen Wolf, the original Teen Wolf, not the stupid MTV show. Shut up, people. The Michael J. Fox version. That guy kills me. He's hysterical because he clearly thinks he's really cool. And he's such a dork. And the rest of the band, it's just, I mean, yeah, their hair's a little weird, their hair, but it's not, I mean, I'm picturing this huge flock of seagulls, when I think flock of seagulls, this huge flop of hair that hangs over the front. I mean, it's this massive thing, and it's not in the video. It's not, I mean, you can see the hair, and it's goofy, but it's not nearly, I mean, my imagination has exaggerated that over the years, but I was just showing Iran, I just showed that video to my son last night, to highlight to him how goofy Flock of Seagulls was, and how iconic that was. Why Flock of Seagulls is still a reference today. Weird. I've just named four. I know I've named four. And as a default, since I can't think anymore, I'll go with, Aha doing Take on Me, because, Talvin himself brought that up in the thread. And yeah, that's an awesome video. That is an awesome, awesome video. Really, really good stuff. And the Family Guy remake homage to that video, not as good. I honestly, that was one of the times where when Family Guy had Chris getting trapped in the Take on Me video, I wound up for the first 15, 20 seconds, I'm like, oh, that's really cool. That is really funny. And then it just went on too long. It's like, okay, I got the joke. Now, you know, you're not adding anything to it. You're not adding humor. You're just showing me what it would look like if they had Chris in that video instead of someone else. I'm not all that taken by that. Also, as like in when Herbert in Family Guy sings Somewhere That's Green, which is a song from Rocky Horror Picture Show, or not Rocky Horror Picture Show, from The Little Shop of Horrors, the other stupid musical. When he sings Somewhere That's Green from Little Shop of Horrors, and sings it as Audrey One, again, the first couple moments of that are really funny. And then he sings the whole god darn song, and it's like, I get it, but he's not singing it well, and he's not adding any humor to it, other than the joke is, what if it was Herbert singing the song? Well, I got that joke in the first 5 seconds. You don't have to sing me the whole song. You really don't. But, oh well, yeah, that's my criticism of Family Guy. So there's my five. All right? Happy? Akiva. Where were you when Kennedy was killed? Were you one of the tramps on the grassy knoll? And how are the Rosicrucians involved? Like, you're the history dude. You tell me, dude. Seriously, I was chilling on a beach in Argentina with the Boys of Summer. So therefore, I was nowhere near the place. I swear to God, I have people who can vouch for me. Talvin says, Rosicrucians. No, we all know it was the military-industrial complex, and they answered the Illuminati. Okay, I'll give you that, Talvin. And if you've never read it, the book Illuminati, do it. Just do it. I've read it twice. And it is a fascinating drug trip. Akiva's answer to that is, oh please, everyone knows the Illuminati are just a front for the Lemurians. And they were using the Cubans and the Boy Scouts to protect Kennedy, albeit unsuccessfully. Only the Rosicrucians had the magical mojo to overcome that protection. And then that's where I say done. And you know what? I think that's dead on. Say goodnight, R2.